Hi, I'm Brian Hollins, and this is The Road Untraveled. Today, we're joined by Rob Goh, co-founder and general partner in NextView. Rob focuses on a wide range of businesses, including e-commerce, productivity, labor marketplaces, real estate tech, and digital health. Prior to NextView, Rob is at Spark Capital, and before that, eBay as product lead. Rob is a phenomenal investor with an incredible track record, and I really enjoyed getting his perspective on shifts in the consumer business model, investing in underrepresented communities, and a variety of other topics. I hope you enjoy our conversation. This is The Road Untraveled.
Hi, Rob. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for being here. For anyone joining us, Rob is a co-founder and partner at NextView. Prior to co-founding NextView, Rob was at Spark Capital and focused on early stage investments in consumer web and mobile. Before Spark, Rob was a business product lead at eBay, where he oversaw the launch of major products that enhanced search, browse, and product discovery experience for tens of millions of users. Rob is also an HBS grad, and I really appreciate him being here, and shout out to Elise Propus for making this introduction to us. But Rob, you know, I would love to start with a piece that you actually put out recently around this transition from FOMO to FOLD. I think it's a really interesting concept, and I think it'd be really helpful for both founders and investors that are listening to better understand kind of what you meant by that.
Yeah, well, thanks again for having me. Really big fan of the show. You know, when the COVID crisis was hitting and we started to see other investors and ourselves included kind of scrambling to figure out what was next, I was trying to think about, like, how do you encapsulate the shift in mindset in a pretty simple way? And, you know, I'd say in a bull market, the venture industry reacts largely on FOMO, so fear of missing out. And that's what drives, you know, kind of a frenzy-like behavior around, like, the hottest companies and the hottest sectors that doesn't always end in the best possible way. Contrast that to periods of massive uncertainty, which is what we live in today. And I think you have a shift from fear of missing out to fear of looking dumb, which is what FOLD stands for. And so, you know, that means a lot of things, but it's kind of obvious, right? When you think about it, stuff like, you know, people will take longer, they'll be more methodical with their decision making. The thing that I worry the most about, though, is it's just going to be a shift towards what is comfortable and has been proven to work in the past, which if I was an LP, I guess that kind of makes sense, but I think is kind of a detriment to the venture world overall. The simplest example of this that I think is the biggest issue is a narrowing of aperture around founder types. So I would say in the last few years, we've seen some pretty positive strides in the industry around being open-minded around first-time founders and particularly, I think, underrepresented minorities and female founders. And my fear is that this is going to reverse pretty dramatically, because if every investor says that they're only going to back founders that they have a referral from a trusted source, especially when it's hard to meet people in person, well, most folks who are outside of the most folks who are you know, in the underrepresented minority group are less likely to have a direct relationship with investors. And so they're starting with a big handicap, which I think is really unsettling and a big negative for the industry at this point.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Let's talk about another thing that came out of that article. And for anyone that hasn't seen it, Rob put together a really nice piece that breaks this down. But another thing that you speak about is this sort of shift to a more conservative business model. So as we see, you know, some of the pullbacks in conservative nature around who you're backing, we also potentially see from a founder perspective a shift to a more consistent sort of SaaS traditional business model. I'm curious sort of what you think the impact of that may be.
Yeah. So again, I feel like there's sometimes a disconnect between what I want to have happen in the world and how money is made. And this, in a way, was starting to happen even before the crisis really hit, right? But, you know, I think in a bull market, optimism is at all-time high, availability of capital is high. And so the types of companies that investors are willing to consider expand. So, you know, during, you know, after the internet bubble burst, there was this big focus on, like, enterprise software, infrastructure investments, kind of classic venture markets. And then, as the market started to heat up, you had a lot more interest in like consumer web, consumer social. A lot of those didn't work, but a lot of those became like the platforms that we use today. If you think about, Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr for a while, and some of these others. And then like things came to a screeching halt to some degree in the economic crisis, but there was so much capital in the market that things kind of rebounded pretty quickly. So, I think when you look at public markets, pure software businesses have been massively rewarded. If you look at the recent IPOs, and then businesses that require moving physical things have been hurt, right? If you think about the Caspers of the world, for example, or WeWork not being able to get out. So a part of me is like, okay, that's how you make money. Like software is like the most beautiful and powerful force as an entrepreneur or a business person. But as a human who loves the innovation kind of economy, the idea that investors were willing to like roll the dice on stuff that seemed really speculative and that seemed like out of the norm seemed like a really good thing. So I don't know. It's probably like it's like a natural organism. There's sort of like a period where, you kind of expand, and then a period of contraction, and maybe that's probably just, natural course of things.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious how you think that plays out in the consumer market, because that's a place where you've spent a good amount of time. If you just think about the sort of source of revenue, consumer is it may be reoccurring, but it's not recurring, right? And so it may not just fit in a traditional SaaS business model. What are the shifts that we see in consumer to help, investors get more comfortable with the potential business impact of this type of thing happening down the road?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. Blue Apron was an interesting company that I feel like took a lot of licks in the public market because they were, I think there are other issues with the business aside, but like in a way, they were trying to shift the framework of how people thought about a service like that. The market, I think, wasn't really ready. But it's sort of like, do you think of McDonald's? Maybe that's a bad example today, but like, does one think of a fast food chain as a subscription business? No. But how many times do you go to one of these fast food chains in a given year? Probably like, 6 to 12 times. And so that's kind of a recurring business, but it's not, right? I think that you're going to see e-commerce companies look a little bit more, I think they ought to be treated a little bit more like that. As opposed to like a pure SaaS subscription type of offering. I think if you look at Chewy, which is the dog food company, or the pet food company, I don't think they're a subscription business, but their dollar retention on a monthly or at least like bi-monthly basis is like extraordinarily great. And I think that's a really good model for businesses to come after that. We're in a business called Grove Collaborative, which sells household CPG products. And similarly, like if you look at their retention on a every 2 months basis, it's pretty extraordinary. And I actually think that this crisis helps some of these businesses because the types of categories that people have historically spent money on for online purchasing has expanded. And so people aren't going to Target and Walmart or Costco as much anymore. And so they're finding their, providers for these types of household consumables. And once they got them, if these businesses do a good job satisfying their customers, I think you're going to see a lot of people stick. So I'm actually really bullish about that transition on the sort of consumer transactional side of things. But I do think that like, you do need to have great lifetime value to be a really, really valuable company. And it's just the way to define that, I think, needs to be a little bit broader than a traditional, like, true subscription business.
That's great. Let's talk a little bit about sort of the valuation expectations that you think we'll start to see in this new norm. How much can you rely on public comps at this point, given the sort of market's ability to stay where it is despite, businesses really starting to turn over, and the economy at large, you know, being in a much worse spot. I think traditionally enterprise businesses have been able to look to publics and say, you know, look, things are trading at 12 to 20 times forward, and that's where I'm going to get marked at. Otherwise, I'll move down the street. How do you think that plays out?
I think there's certainly a dislocation between economic realities and public markets overall, and so I think that's. I think it is. How should I say? I think that these valuations are useful because ultimately, you know, businesses are going to be valued based on some sort of a comp like that. But in the near term, I think there's a pretty big dislocation. I think the, you know, high growth, successful software businesses, you know, there's sort of a flight to quality, and so they're doing disproportionately well. But you know, in a world where you're seeing like 20x revenue multiples, that basically says that the value of that company is, you know, it's like a business that has no cost and distributes out 100% of the revenue for 20 years. Like, is that a fair assessment of the value of the enterprise? I don't know about that. So it's, I don't know. I don't know what to make of it. I think in our neck of the woods, valuations at the seed stage and early stage is driven by competition, right? It's like, what is the level of demand for the equity of a company? And so, you know, valuations are all over the place. I think that most seed funds that I know are expecting a 20 to 30% reduction in valuation, but most haven't actually seen it yet. Because the companies that people want to invest in, again, in a world where it's FOMO versus FOLD, people tend to gravitate towards the same number of companies, the same companies, and so it becomes a frenzy for those investments as well, and so pricing is still relatively high. Actually, one other thing I would probably add is that in our sector, it's interesting to see what some of the, you know, Series A and Series B funds might be doing, because their version of fold might be, let's write smaller checks into earlier stage companies and maybe even let like the mid-level investment professionals do those because they have more time and capacity versus the senior folks who might be dealing with, you know, nightmares in their portfolio. And so, you know, that puts pressure on us because you have these, you know, $400 or $500 million funds that are relatively price insensitive, especially when they're talking about doing a $1 million check into a seed stage company. So that's another force that actually is propping up the value of seed stage businesses within, you know, a certain profile of company.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Let's talk a little bit about the NextView portfolio. You know, I'd imagine, as you just sort of alluded to, you're spending more time with your founders than you traditionally would when it's just kind of call check-ins and a quarterly board meeting. I'm curious if you've, you know, seen any best practices around effective communication of those founders with investors, and anything that you would share with founders that are trying to run and keep their business afloat while also helping investors, you know, stay calm and allow them to just sort of do their job.
Yeah, so actually, we're pretty high engagement fund. So we do probably fewer investments on a per partner basis at the seed stage than any other seed fund in the country. So I actually don't think our engagement level is that much higher today. I think some funds that have historically not been as engaged are like, oh my gosh, there's so much work because all of a sudden, you know, there's a bunch of fires. And we are engaging more, but I think the difference is a little bit less acute. So I think there's sort of two stages to this. I actually think that there is a very human and emotional component to this during the I think there's sort of two phases, right? There's like the there's this acute like pandemic phase, and then there's the, you know, longer term recession phase. During this acute pandemic phase, people don't know what's going on. They're executing on, you know, huge shifts in the way that they work. It's a lot of pressure on the CEOs. And so I actually encourage founders and investors to try to connect to each other in a personal way, because, you know, I think that's what people need. And I think that as an investor, you're thinking to yourself, like, what is the mindset of this founder? Are they actually doing okay? You know, and I think being a little bit vulnerable on both ends, I think, is really helpful in establishing that trust. I think that, you know, kind of beyond that, you know, the best practices I found are not so dissimilar than what the best practices are during normal markets, where, you know, you want to be transparent. I like companies that do monthly written updates. We always recommend doing a you know, even if there isn't a board, having some sort of a regular call or meeting cadence that allows you to review results, review goals, and be accountable to one another. I've had some portfolio companies that have gone from like a normal cadence to like literally weekly written updates, which I think was actually, or have gone from like calls every 6 weeks to like calls every 2 weeks. Most of those we're now unwinding, because, you know, it's sort of like once we got our feet under us, we're like, okay, things are in okay shape. Let's go back to a normal cadence because it's getting a little like redundant. So I think that was appropriate for a while as everyone was trying to figure out what's going on, but, there's most founders have better things to do than talk to investors. Yeah.
As they should. Let's talk about your sort of, let's put your investing hat on for a second. How do you source in this market? How do you find seed companies in this new norm that we live in, when, you know, it's mostly on Zoom, you aren't really able to look them in the eye and see if they're serious about it? What are some of the things that you're finding helpful to assess businesses and teams in the early stage right now?
Yeah. Well, I think the sourcing and the assessing are two different things. I think on the sourcing side, some of our thoughts are that, you know, within the Fold framework, the companies that are out that people might look dumb investing in might be the most interesting. The ones that might look dumb are the things that are really, really early, or things that maybe have raised a seed round and for whatever reason need to raise another round to get to the Series A. Things are going well, but they're not quite there yet, or they had a slow start, or, you know, they're in a category that has some market headwinds because of COVID, but that's going to go away and could actually be an opportunity. So like, those are the two areas that we think about from a sourcing standpoint where we want to put disproportionate effort. And there's sort of different tactics for each. I think on the latter, it's about like really close relationships with our co-investors and, you know, trusting that, you know, we can work with them to find opportunities in their portfolios, similar to ones that we have in our portfolio of companies we have conviction about, but, you know, have, you know, they, for whatever reason, they need additional capital and, but it's still an awesome investment opportunity. I think on the former, you know, one of the things we've done is that we've created an accelerator program, to try to attract these types of companies. You know, so we were one of the first to talk about doing a virtual accelerator. We think that there's a bit of a market gap as, you know, YC is clearly like the big dog in the accelerator world. There are tons of other accelerators out there that are, you know, I think there's a variation in quality. And I think there's a fair bit of fatigue around the model. And so, you know, we thought it made sense to kind of do our version of this and we could have some, we could attract interesting companies that are different and make our mark in that way. So that's sort of from the sourcing side. On the evaluation front, I think it is tough. We've always been, there's an awesome book called Who, WHO, written by a guy named Jeff Smart. And it is basically a framework for interviewing and reference checking. What's interesting is that the core research behind that book was actually VC decision-making. So how VCs evaluated management teams. That is sort of like my main handbook, and it relies very little, sorry, not to go too deep into this, but basically what they found was most VCs do the like, oh, I had dinner with the founders or I met them a couple times and I just have a good feeling about them, right? It's kind of this intangibles. I've done this a million times. I have had a recognition. This person's good. And basically what they found was that that method like totally sucks. And the thing you should do is like have a list of attributes that are important for being a founder and for being the founder for this particular company. And then trying to assess through interview questions and reference checking how the founder actually compares to those attributes. And so it's unnatural to do an interview with a founder, so we don't do that. But we do a lot of extensive reference checking, and we're very targeted around the things that we think are going to matter for that business. And so I feel like when you can't meet somebody in person, you can still do that pretty effectively. What you lose is the like natural rapport and trust and some of the emotional connection that you get from knowing somebody and meeting somebody. And I'm not exactly sure how you overcome that, but I think as everybody gets better at remote communication, we'll hopefully figure it out.
Yeah, that's great. Last one for you, Rob. This has been super fun. I appreciate you being here. Let's talk about some of the efficiencies you might have found so far in working remotely or collaborating with folks over Zoom. You know, I'm curious if there's any silver linings or things that you plan to bring, you know, into your normal life after this pandemic that may not have existed before we were sort of forced into this.
That's a good question. Well, I'm not traveling or commuting, so that's a little bit of found time. I am doing homeschooling for for one of my two kids, and so that takes that away. Oh, wow. You know, in terms of other efficiencies, you know, we have our team actually connects as a whole team much more frequently than we historically have in the past, and I think that's been kind of good. You know, it was about basically like replicating the water cooler experience where you can kind of like run into somebody and just like get really, really quick feedback on a company or an idea or a theme that you're considering. And so we've tried to replicate that with Zoom. What's been interesting is, you know, because we're a multi-office firm, the water cooler chats, they happen, but they don't happen in as great frequency as I think we'd like. And I really like my partners and my team members, and we it's nice to have the time to spend together. So I actually think the dexterity of our decision-making, the speed has been faster because we're just able to get inputs from each other much more quickly and you know, in a more continuous fashion. So I think that's been really good. I don't have a ton of other kind of productivity hacks. I feel like, you know, I'm still in the zone of being less productive than before because I'm context switching all the time, which is a drag.
Yeah, absolutely. Rob Goh, founder and partner at NextView. Thank you so much for being here. This was really fun.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. Great questions. And I hope it's fun and interesting for your listeners.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Rob.
Thank you.
Take care.